Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. I think it's fair to say we all have things we'd like to change. The classics, you know, exercise more, look at your iPhone screen less, save money, quit smoking. Whatever the challenge may be, my next guest, James Clear, offers a framework for improving every day. Clear is one of the world's leading experts on habit formation. In his new book, Atomic Habits, An Easy, Proven Way to Build Good Habits and Break Bad Ones, he reveals practical strategies that will teach you to master the tiny behaviors that can lead to remarkable results. Clear is the creator of the Habits Academy. More than 500,000 people subscribe to his weekly email newsletter, jamesclear.com. Atomic Habits is published by Avery Books, and James Clear, welcome to All of It.
Oh, thank you so much.
Is that your real name, first of all?
Yes, it is. I just got lucky, I guess. It's not a pen name.
Just thinking in terms of clarity and being clear on what you want. Your personal story actually is really interesting, and it led you to the work you do. Could you share that with us?
Sure. So when I was in high school, I suffered a very serious injury. I was hit in the face with a baseball bat. It was an accident, but the consequences and the fallout from that were significant. So, you know, I suffered multiple seizures, had to be air carried to the hospital, couldn't breathe on my own. I was placed into a medically induced coma overnight and then released the next day. And it really took 8 or 9 months before I was able to recover from that. And to tie it into the concepts that I mentioned in Atomic Habits, it was really the first time when I was forced to practice small habits, right? Like I didn't really have a choice. I couldn't just flip a switch and, you know, transform overnight or go back to the normal life that I had before. I had to find small ways to get better each day. And so I didn't have the language for it then, but that was when I first, you know, experimented and tried out, what does it look like to get 1% better each day or to try to make some small improvement? Because that's what I was doing at physical therapy or other areas of my life.
Because you quite literally had to.
Correct.
For folks who want to get in on this conversation, maybe you have a question for James or you want to offer up your way of changing a habit, good or bad. I guess you want to keep the good ones. Please call us at 212-433-9692. What habits are you trying to change? Do you have a question for James? What's worked for you when it comes to breaking a bad habit? Give us a call at 212-433-9692. Everybody always wants to know, how long does it take to make a habit?
Yeah, this is probably the most common question that I get. And there are, you see all kinds of things, right? 21 days, 30 days, 100 days. There was one study done that showed that it was about 66 days on average, but even that was, the range was quite wide. You know, if you chose an easy habit, like drinking a glass of water at lunch, it was maybe 3 weeks. If you chose a difficult habit, like going for a run after work each day, it might be 7 or 8 months. But really, I think it's more useful to answer this in two ways. The first is habits do not form based on time. They form based on repetitions. You know, 30 days can pass and you can do something once or you can do it 100 times or 1,000 times. So it's really repetition that instills a habit. But the second and deeper issue is that when we ask questions like, how long does it take to build a habit? The implicit assumption is, well, how long until this is easy, right? How long until I don't have to work anymore? And habits are not a finish line to be crossed. They're a lifestyle to be lived. And so the honest answer to how long does it take to build a habit is forever, because once you stop doing it, it's no longer a habit. And I think that looking at it that way helps people view these as sustainable lifestyle changes, small, tiny improvements that you can make and stick to over the long run. And that's really the type of habit change that lasts.
I'm wondering about mindset, because there's habits we want to change and there's the I should change. And I have to imagine that the difference between want to and should can make a difference.
Sure. So this is something I talk about in chapter two, this idea of what I call identity-based habits. And the point here, the central point, is that saying I want this versus saying I am this are two very different things. And once you adopt a behavior as part of your identity, you know, like I am a smoker or I'm a procrastinator or something positive, like I'm the type of person who doesn't miss workouts or I'm the type of person who writes one sentence every day. Once you believe those things about yourself, you're not even really pursuing behavior change anymore. You're just acting in alignment with the type of person you already believe that you are. So in a sense, true behavior change is actually identity change. It leads to some kind of fundamental shift in how you see yourself. And this is another reason why I believe small habits are so useful, which is that even if a small habit does not radically transform your results right away, like doing 5 push-ups, that's not going to change your body overnight, but it is casting a vote for being the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. And I think that this is the best lever that we have for changing our beliefs about ourselves, which is small habits that you stick to kind of act like, you know, every action you take is a vote for the type of person that you think that you are. Mm-hmm. And as you cast more votes, you build up evidence of, hey, this is the type of person I am. And eventually you cross this invisible threshold where you say, okay, I believe this about myself now.
Let's go to Michael online too. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Did you kick a bad habit?
I did. I smoked for about 30 years and I got sick one day, and I don't get sick very often. So when I do, I'm generally down for the count. And I was down for about 5 days, and I hadn't smoked a cigarette, obviously, in all 5 days. Then I started to feel better, and I went and I grabbed a cigarette and I lit it just out of habit. And it tasted disgusting. And I was like, ugh. You know, I put it out just immediately and said to myself, you know, I've gone 5 days so far. Let's see if I can go one more day. And that's how I started my incremental drop-off, because I didn't force myself. I didn't say I quit smoking. I carried the cigarettes. I had about 6 cigarettes, and I carried them around with me. And I made a deal with myself. If I want to smoke, I'm going to go ahead and light it. And every time I did or went to light it, I would light it once or twice and then put it out, just reminding myself how the taste, again, was disgusting. And I was like, I'll do better. And I had read someplace where 72 hours is generally the threshold for you to lose the craving to something. So I think a lot of my craving still for the cigarette was psychological, but, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I don't know that for a fact. But the point is, I kept the cigarettes with me for about 2 months, carried them with me, and just opening the pack and smelling the cigarette that I had lit and put back into the pack was enough for me to not do it anymore. And then one day I just threw the cigarettes away, and I haven't smoked since.
All right, Michael, good on you. Thanks for calling in. If you want to join this conversation, our number is 212-433-9692. My guest is James Clear. He's written a book called Atomic Habits, An Easy Proven Way to Build Good Habits and Break Bad Ones. If you want to share what habits you want to change, or if you want to ask James a question, we would love to hear from you. Okay, what is that relationship between starting a good habit and breaking a bad one?
Well, they don't necessarily require different strategies, but they do require perhaps different angles of the same strategy. So in the book, I talk about what I lay out as the 4 laws of behavior change. And so basically for a good habit, you want to make it obvious, make it attractive, make it easy, make it satisfying. So those are the
four. Give me an example of those 4 things.
Sure. So I'll give you one for building a good habit and breaking a bad one.
Yeah.
So for building a good habit, like let's take flossing. For many years, I noticed that I would brush my teeth twice a day, but I wouldn't floss consistently. And one of the problems was that the floss was tucked away in a drawer in the bathroom, so I just wouldn't see it. The other issue, and it sounds kind of silly, but I didn't like the feeling of wrapping the floss around my fingers, like mm-hmm. It was uncomfortable. So what I did was I employed the first law of behavior change, make it obvious. So mm-hmm. I took it out of the drawer, put it in a bowl, and then placed that bowl right next to the toothbrush. So I brushed my teeth, put the toothbrush down, floss is right there. And then I also bought some of those pre-made flossers and used those to floss, because then I didn't have the discomfort of wrapping them around my fingers.
And that's the second principle, which was?
The third law, which is make it easy.
Make it easy.
Yeah. So by employing those two, in that case, I was able to build a habit. And that was pretty much all I needed to do for that one. All right, now let's take breaking a bad habit. So for a good habit, it's make it obvious, make it attractive, make it easy, make it satisfying. For a bad habit, you just invert those.
Oh.
So you want to make it invisible, make it unattractive, make it difficult, or make it unsatisfying. So take the habit of like watching too much Netflix or watching too much TV. People feel like they spend all this time looking at the screen. Well, if you walk into pretty much any living room, where do all the couches and chairs face? They all face the television. So it's like,
right.
What is this room designed to get you to do? It's the most obvious, most frictionless, easy thing in that environment. So there are a couple things you could do. You could take the TV and put it inside a wall unit or a cabinet so that it's behind doors and less obvious. You could take the remote control and put it in a drawer so that you're less likely to see it, and maybe put a book in its place. You could take one of the chairs and turn it so it's not facing the TV anymore. But you could also increase the friction of the task. So, you know, you could take the batteries out of the remote control, and then every time you want to turn the TV on, it adds an extra 5 or 10 seconds. So it's enough time to say, do I really want to watch this, or am I just turning it on mindlessly? Or you could unplug the TV after each use and only plug it back in if you can say the name of the show that you want to watch. So you aren't allowed to just like pull Netflix up and find something. And finally, you know, if you really wanted to be extreme about it, you could take the TV off the wall and put it in the closet and only set it up if you really wanted to watch something that bad. But the point here is that there are varying levels of extremity, but you want to design an environment where there are fewer steps between you and the good behaviors and more steps between you and the bad ones. And if you make your good habits the more convenient, frictionless option, you're more likely to slide into them.
On your website, you wrote, "I believe the best way to change the world is in concentric circles. Start with yourself and work your way out from there." Why did you believe that? What's the theory behind that?
Well, I mean, you can look at pretty much any large group, like a team or an organization or a society, and they're just a collection of individuals, right? Like everybody who lives in this city is an individual, and together we make a group, a society. If each person shows up as their best self each day, if each person shows up with slightly better habits, slightly more nuanced beliefs, slightly more educated, the whole society benefits.
Are good habits contagious?
Yeah. So actually all habits are contagious. Ah. There are some very interesting studies done. So both good and bad. For example, if one spouse loses weight, then the other spouse is more likely, I think about 30% more likely to lose weight themselves. I cite this study in the book. And then on the flip side, if you have a friend who becomes obese, you are 57% more likely to become obese yourself, even if the friend doesn't live in the same city. They found that the connection holds even if they live up to 500 miles away. Now, the point here is not about gaining or losing weight. The point is just that many of our habits are socially reinforced. And so the people that we're around and the tribes that we are a part of play a significant role in what behaviors are attractive or normal to you.
Let's take a couple of calls. I think we have some questions for you. Alice in New York, hi.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, what do you need help with, Alice?
I have a bad habit of picking on my nails and getting them below the quick, I think it's called, you know, down below where I can't, I can't, you know, pick on it anymore.
That's uncomfortable. So what do you think? What's something that Alice could do?
So if you want to break a bad habit, your options are, again, make it invisible, make it unattractive, make it difficult, make it unsatisfying.
So make it difficult for her to get to her cuticles.
Right. So if it's your own fingers, you can't make them invisible, right?
Yes.
And there is something that's attractive about doing it. In other words, there's a reason the habit serves you right now. That's why we do all habits, even bad habits. They serve us in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, usually bad habits serve us in an immediate fashion. So the question is, what are you getting out of this right now? You know, is it a way to reduce anxiety or stress?
Like a nervous thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is it a way to resolve boredom? And so if you can understand what the deeper root cause is, then you can try to find a different way to resolve that feeling rather than the current bad habit that you have. And then the third option, which you just mentioned, is let's make it really difficult. You know, wrap tape around your fingers. Some people put that kind of nail polish on that, you know, tastes terrible or something like that. So, you're basically trying to employ those four laws.
Maurice in Long Island. Hi, Maurice.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. What's going on in your life?
Everything's fine, but I do have a habit of drinking sugar ginger ale, and basically I am supposed to drink fluids, but I just like drinking ginger ale. And the problem is that, you know, my mouth is like a bank. I basically have to put a lot of money into it because something's going on, and it's probably the sugar. But how do you break a simple habit that seems to give me some kind of satisfaction when I know it's not good for me?
All right, Maurice, thanks for calling in. That's tough. When the habit you know you should break, but you like it on some level.
So this is what I call the cardinal rule of behavior change in the book, which is behaviors that are immediately rewarded get repeated, and behaviors that are immediately punished get avoided. And I love that he said, you know, how do I change something that's satisfying to me? Because this is why we stick with all habits. They provide some sense of satisfaction, some positive emotional signal that says to your brain, hey, this felt good. You should do this again next time. So I think in this case, you have two options that could be effective. The first is make it invisible, reduce exposure. So don't keep it in the house is a common diet one, right? Like if you never buy it, then you're not going to have it. So the question there is maybe less about the actual thing that you're drinking and more about your purchase habits. How can I alter my behavior when I'm at the store so that I make sure it doesn't make it into the cart or the bag? The second option, though, is to try to find an alternative that provides a similar level of satisfaction. So it sounds like he knows, hey, this is more satisfying to me than water. But it's possible, and many people do this, who find themselves like drinking too much soda, for example. They'll swap it out for LaCroix or something like that, which doesn't provide the same type of sugar, but does give the same kind of carbonated feel. So I would suggest try to reduce exposure and change your buying habits and try to figure out a different drink that leads to a similar level of satisfaction without a similar level of sugar.
My guest is James Clear. He's written a book called Atomic Habits, An Easy Proven Way to Build Good Habits and Break Bad Ones. So I know what good habits are and bad habits. What are atomic habits?
Yeah, good question. So Atomic Habits was written to be the most comprehensive book on how to change and improve habits. And I chose the phrase for three reasons. So the first reason is the word atomic can mean tiny or small. And that is a big part of my philosophy. Habits should be small and easy to do. The second meaning of atomic is that it's the fundamental unit of a larger system. So atoms build into molecules, molecules build into compounds, and so on. And I think that we can look at our daily habits in a similar way. Like they're kind of these fundamental patterns that make up the larger system of our lives. And then the third reason or the third meaning of atomic is the source of immense energy or power. And I think that if you combine all three of those definitions, you understand the narrative arc of the book, which is if you make changes that are small and easy to do, and you layer them on top of each other like fundamental units in a larger system, then you can end up with powerful or remarkable results.
Do I have to have willpower to sustain this, or will this somehow become sort of organic into my life?
Yeah, great question. So I think that willpower, generally speaking, is overrated as a behavior change tactic. It is good for the short term, but not an effective long-term strategy for change. And I think you're hinting at it right here. You're like, well, you know, maybe I can have willpower for a week or a day, but I'm not going to have it for a year. And the more effective strategy, and there's some interesting research studies that have been done on this. Some of the most recent studies on self-control show that the people who appear to exhibit the highest amount of self-control are actually those who are tempted the least. So from the outside, you look at them and you're like, man, they never do the wrong thing. But what's actually going on internally is they just don't face temptations as much. And so the lesson here is that the most effective way to improve your amount of self-control is to redesign your environment so that you face fewer temptations. So for example, if you're trying to lose weight, don't follow food blogs on Instagram. You're constantly being prompted, right, and having to resist. If you're trying to spend money on electronics, don't watch or read all the latest tech review blogs or the tech reviewers on YouTube and things like that. Yeah. You're constantly being triggered to buy another product. And so if you can reduce the amount of temptations that are in your environment, for many of us in our digital environment, then you'll find that willpower often increases naturally, or it looks like it does, but it's just because you're being tempted less.
Let's go to Vita. Hi, Vita. You calling from the Lower East Side?
Yes, yes. Hi. I was talking, I always hated going to the gym. And I avoided it like the plague. And then one day I decided I must start going to the gym. And I promised myself I would only do it for 10 minutes. I would go there, just, you know, get on the treadmill 10 minutes and then leave. So I started, you know, I signed up, I enrolled, and I started going every day. And I would get out, you know, first few days I got out after 10 minutes. And slowly, automatically, you know, as you feel stronger, I started making it 15, 20, 30 minutes, etc. So even though I absolutely hated it, just by starting off at 10 minutes, I kind of, you know, made it into a habit.
Vita, thanks for sharing her story. Vita is a case point. You start small, let it grow.
I'm so happy that she shared that example because it's similar to one of my favorite stories. So one of my readers lost over 100 pounds. And one of the things that he did was he went to the gym, but he didn't allow himself to stay for longer than 5 minutes. And he did this for the first like 6 weeks. And it sounds silly to people, but like what Vita is mentioning here, the thing about that many people overlook about habits is that a habit must be established before it can be improved. And what I mean by that is you have to master the art of showing up. But so often in the beginning, we're focused on finding the best diet plan or the best workout program or the perfect business idea. And when you're so focused on finding the optimal strategy, you end up optimizing for the finish line. Like, okay, what's the best way for me to lose 20 pounds in the next 6 months? And you forget about optimizing for the starting line. But every habit is just an exercise in getting started each day. And if you can figure out how to show up and start again and again, then you actually have options, right? Like once you become the type of person who goes to the gym 4 days a week, even if it's only for 5 minutes, now you have a choice. Now you're like, well, how, you know, what type of workout should I do? Or should I get a personal trainer? Or how can I improve this in some way? But most people do the opposite. They try to optimize for the finish line rather than the starting line. And I think most of us would be better served if we figured out how to standardize it in our lives before we tried to optimize it.
Is there any way to make trying to change a bad habit not feel restrictive? Because people think like, I've taken this thing away from myself, or I've put myself in this lane when I really want to be over in the other lane.
It's a great question. So I'll often refer to many of these as like habits of avoidance. So for example, I don't want to drink alcohol for 30 days, or I don't want to spend money on Amazon, or we're going to try to not go out to eat as much. Now, it's really difficult for habits like those, for behavior changes like those, to not feel restrictive, because dinner time rolls around and you think, oh, I just want to go out to eat, but then you're just resisting that, right? You're sitting with temptation.
You feel deprived as well.
So there is a kind of like a backdoor solution. So one of my readers, he and his wife, they wanted to eat out less and cook more so they could be more healthy, save money, and so on. So what they did was they set up a savings account and they labeled it Trip to Europe, and then every day that they did not go out to eat and stayed home to cook instead, they would transfer $50 over to that account. So technically, they're still resisting the thing that, you know, like you're mentioning, they're resisting the bad habit. But they invert it a little bit, right? Because now they can see the account growing. And so there's like a positive signal of doing nothing, of doing the thing that, of avoiding the thing they don't want to do. And little bits of satisfaction like that can count for a lot. Because they give you a reason to say, hey, this, you know what, like it was enjoyable to see the Trip to Europe account go up. And so now maybe we're a little more likely to do it again next time.
Let's go to Susan, who's calling us from Long Beach. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you? I'm a longtime listener and first time caller, and I love the new show.
Oh, thanks a bunch. We appreciate it. What's your question?
How would you apply these principles to someone who is chronically late?
Oh, that is a pet peeve of mine. I am chronically early.
Well, that's good. That's a good habit. Yeah, great question. So many times, and I am someone who's been guilty of this in the past, people can be chronically late for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they're trying to fit too much in. Sometimes they just don't have a sense of urgency about it. But one thing is that you have to figure out like what's attractive to you. And so all behaviors are performed because there's some level of motivation or attraction that's related to them. And like my brother, for example, who is often late, it doesn't seem like it's very compelling or attractive to him to show up on time. It's just not a big motivator. And so because of that, you have to find something else that gets him motivated. So if it's tying it to something, this is a strategy that I talk about in the book called temptation bundling. So we can tie this to just a general question about procrastination. But take someone who procrastinates on exercise, for example, or is late, so to speak, to the gym.
Procrastinates on leaving on time.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
Well, so one of the examples in the book is this engineering student who he tied his bike to his computer, and his Netflix would only run if he was cycling. So if he wasn't cycling, then Netflix wouldn't turn on. That's a good example of temptation bundling, which is you take something you should do and tie it to something you want to do. So for example, if you're late and you have a book you really want to read, only allow yourself to read the book when you're on the subway. And so you have motivation to get out the door so that you can do the thing that you want to do.
Excellent. We only have a few more minutes left. Are there one or two habits that you think just universally, if people changed or got into this good habit, they would have a dramatic improvement in their lives?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll give you three.
Okay, great.
The first one is reading. The habit of reading is kind of like a meta habit, because if you're into the habit of reading, you can solve almost any other problem that you face. Like, want to figure out how to start a podcast? You can read a book on that. Want to learn how to get in shape? You can read a book on that. Want to learn how to write a book? You can read a book on it. Any problem that you go through, the habit of reading can help you solve that. The second one is sleep. So many of us are sleep deprived, and we read articles like how to double your productivity or something like that. But the true answer of how to double your productivity, probably the biggest lever you can pull, is make sure you get 8 hours of sleep each night. Now, I often hear from parents when I say things like that, who say, like, you don't understand what it's like to have, you know, three kids under seven. It's impossible for me. But the point still stands that getting rest is a huge win. And so that's a great habit to focus on. And then I may be a little bit biased here because I enjoy weightlifting so much, but I'll say the habit of exercise is also a huge one. You know, all of us can benefit from having a body that's in better shape, but also it's just important to move. Like, to be human means that you have a body. And so to move that in some way is part of the human experience. And I think will probably lead to greater dividends in many areas of your life.
The name of the book is Atomic Habits, an easy, proven way to build good habits and to break bad ones. James Clear, thanks so much for being with us on All of It.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. In the 1944 film Gaslight, Ingrid Bergman played a woman whose manipulative husband is trying to convince her that she's going crazy. He does so by creating all these false narratives in their lives to make her question reality. The name of the film comes from him making the gaslights in the house flicker and then deny it's happening. The term gaslighting has seen a surge in popularity recently, from politics to news to business to reality TV. In her new book, Gaslighting, Recognizing Manipulative and Emotionally Abusive People and Break Free, Dr. Stephanie Moulton-Sarkis delves into the psychology behind the phenomenon and reveals how gaslighting can happen in dating, in relationships, in families, and even at work. And she is joining us to help us figure out how to identify it and then how to avoid it. Dr. Sarkis, nice to be with you.
Thank you for having me on.
So I gave sort of a Reader's Digest version of gaslighting. Could you give us the proper definition?
Sure. Gaslighting is a series of manipulation tactics that are part of what we would call emotional abuse. The goal is to keep you off kilter and for the gaslighter to gain control over you and also make you more dependent on them. And they also tend to isolate you, alienate you from your family and friends.
That sounds like the kind of things you hear about abuse, women who are abused.
Yeah, and again, it's part of an emotional abuse thing, and you can see gaslighting without you know, non-relationships. You can see it at work. You can see it in politics. As you said, it's pervasive across all areas where you come in contact with people. You can run into people that have this gaslighting, narcissistic, sociopathic type of personality.
Can you give me an example of someone being gaslighting happening at work?
Sure. It could be that you're told that what you saw or what you heard wasn't true, that you saw your boss going through somebody's computer and you say to him, well, that doesn't sound quite right. And he said, well, you didn't see anything. That didn't happen. Or you have a coworker that sabotages all your work. They said, oh, sure, I'll turn on our project, and they don't do it. Or they tell the boss that you didn't contribute to the project at all. So they try to be the most important person in the office, and so they will do whatever they can to throw everyone else under the bus.
So what's the difference between gaslighting and just being a liar?
Just being a liar is that people do lying for self-preservation. So they do lying because they're trying to get out of something or they're trying to make their life better somehow. When you have a gaslighter, they're lying just for the sake of lying. They're lying because they like to see people squirm and they like to see people suffer. So there's a whole other purpose to the lying. And it's also very planned. It's very thought ahead how they're going to manipulate people.
How have we seen it in politics recently?
In politics, you'll see, you know, Donald Trump said, what you're seeing and what you're hearing isn't real. Straight quote. So that is clearly a form of gaslighting. Just going back to the first stages of it, the inauguration crowd, you know, saying, oh, how great it was, and then somebody posted a photo of how few people were there. We've seen it several times through politics. And it's not just one party or the other. You see gaslighting in all different sorts of political orientations. So it's trying to get control over people. It's trying to fool people into thinking that something isn't true or isn't real. We've heard the quote fake news, the hashtag fake news. That's a gaslighting tactic that is trying to get you to think that legitimate news sources aren't legitimate.
Would it be helpful if everyone stopped using the term?
It would be helpful. I think it's also important to call it out when you see it. So when we see someone gaslighting, I think it's important to state, hey, you're gaslighting. This is the actual fact. Now, that person may not cop to it because that's not what gaslighters do. They never admit that they're wrong or apologize. But at least we're speaking truth to what they're doing. And so I think that can make a big difference in letting other people know this is happening.
And I think perhaps one of the more dangerous places where this can happen is in relationships. And I have to imagine that online dating is particularly conducive to gaslighters.
Right, because on online dating, gaslighters can be whoever they want to be. They can look really good on paper, but they are very toxic to be around. So also, when you're doing online dating, the way you write your profile, if you write that you're a sensitive person or that you care about others or that you're really looking for a relationship to work out this time, gaslighters will prey on that. They're really looking for people that are emotionally sensitive. They're looking for people that are empathic because they know that you might possibly accept more of their behavior than someone else would.
So there are personality types that are susceptible to gaslighters.
Yes, especially if you've stated anything about that you are looking for someone that fills a gap in your life or that you're looking for someone to kind of fix things. If you make any allusions to that, gaslighters see that and they zero in on it. In the beginning of the relationship, though, they do this thing called love bombing, where they make you feel like you're the best thing in the world. They'll tell you how great you are, that you're so great compared to other people they've gone out with, which, you know, is supposed to feel good, but it's way overdone. And they also will push you into making a commitment really early on. And part of that is that they want to gain control over you before you realize that they have pathology.
We're speaking with Dr. Stephanie Moulton-Sarkis, author of Gaslighting, Recognize Manipulative and Emotionally Abusive People and Break Free. Is this an official psychiatric disorder of some sort?
It's not listed in the DSM as a diagnostic disorder, but we do see it in diagnoses such as narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder, also commonly known as sociopathy.
Now, you wrote in your book that manipulation in of itself is not necessarily a malevolent bad thing. What do you mean by that?
So manipulation is a way of influencing. So if you look at sales, if you look at, again, politics, you know, you have someone that influences other people. With gaslighting, the manipulation is more very thought out. And again, the purpose is to control people and to make them dependent on you. And in manipulation, you know, it's not always a bad thing. Manipulation can get you what you need in life. It's just, again, the gaslighter uses it for nefarious purposes.
You also write about using triangulation as a tactic. Tactic was one of the words you used early on. What is the tactic of triangulation?
Triangulation is the classic, well, this person, I need you to send this message to them. And then when you tell that other person, then they go back to the gaslighter, and the gaslighter said, I never said that to them. So it's setting you up to fail. It's setting you up to look like a liar to the other party. So what you do with that is you tell the gaslighter, yeah, I'm not sending that message for you. You need to tell them directly, and that will cut that off right away. They also do something called splitting, which is pitting you against people. So they'll say, well, you know, your friend said something about you, and I don't really want to tell you, but here, I'll tell you anyway. And then you get mad at the friend, when in fact they never said anything about you in the first place. Gaslighters are notorious for lying about what other people are saying and then telling you about it so they can sit back and watch you fight with the other person.
I'm sure people are listening to this and saying, like, oh, that sounds like Amy in my office, or that sounds like my friend's boyfriend. That sounds just like that person. So why do we put up with gaslighters?
Well, it's very slow, this process. So when you first meet a gaslighter, you may not be totally aware that they have these characteristics, but over time they start coming out. And gaslighters know to ramp up the behavior slowly. It's kind of like the frog in the frying pan. You know, they turn up the heat little by little. So we have people that have been in relationships for months, even years, and they aren't aware of how manipulated they've been until way far down the line. Even people that are mental health clinicians have gotten into these relationships, and you'd think of all people they would know the pathology. But again, because the gaslighter is so good at hiding it and just picking at you little by little, you don't even realize until your self-esteem has bottomed out.
So how can we decrease their influence in our lives?
Well, one of the things you have to do if you're in a relationship with one is to completely cut off contact. Now, that's a lot easier said than done if you don't have kids. But what you need to do is go radio silence. And what I mean by that is blocking all their emails, blocking all their phone numbers, because gaslighters do this thing called hoovering, like the vacuum cleaner. They will try to suck you back into a relationship. So they will do whatever it takes because they have this what's called a narcissistic void. And if they aren't getting attention, they will come after you to bring you back into the fold. So, again, that's something you really have to watch for. If you have kids, I recommend that people consult with an attorney and get a very detailed parenting plan. And that specifies exactly what both parents should and should not be doing. One of the things that gaslighting co-parents do is that they may try to alienate you from your kids. kids. And the parenting plan puts in very clear terms, again, what behavior is acceptable and what's not.
It's a fascinating book. It's called Gaslighting, Recognize Manipulative and Emotionally Abusive People and Break Free. Dr. Stephanie Moulton-Sarkis, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Oh, you're welcome.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.